Welcome to installment number 106 of New World Notes, cleverly titled Psychopaths with Occam's Razor. And to begin our second look at psychopathy, let's start with Occam's Razor. Now, Occam's Razor is not what the teenage psychos used in Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. It was named after a 14th century philosophically minded Franciscan friar known as William of Ockham. And no, I don't know why they didn't name it William's Razor. Occam's Razor is a heuristic, that is, a tool to aid discovery. In its simplest forms, it goes like this. If you have two competing plausible explanations for something, pick the simpler of the two. Here's an example. Lying dead on the sidewalk in front of police headquarters, a tall building downtown, is the late chairman of the city's Black Panther Party. His hands are handcuffed behind his back, his skull is cracked, and he's surrounded by a pool of blood. Before the TV camera crews reach the scene, the police department will have issued a press release stating that the deceased had somehow gotten through the security doors in the lobby, run up 14 flights of stairs, grabbed a pair of handcuffs a detective had carelessly left in an unlocked room, put them on, used his head to smash the glass in the hall window, and jumped to his death because of an unhappy development in a homosexual love affair he was having, to the great surprise of all who knew him. That's the Rube Goldberg explanation. A simpler but also plausible explanation is that policemen have no great love for radical male black activists or any other challenge to the established order. That they arrested the fellow on some trumped-up charge, handcuffed him, beat him, defenestrated him, that means pushed him out the window, and are now lying through their teeth. That's the simpler explanation. Occam says, all other things being equal, the simpler explanation is more likely to be true. Pick the simpler explanation. Or consider the events of 9/11/2001, the official conspiracy theory, as codified in the 9/11 Commission report, is so patently unbelievable on its face, leaves so many key issues unexamined, calls for so many bizarre leaps of logic, that the thing doesn't even deserve refutation. It doesn't even come close to making a prima facie case for the official fairy tale. Any schoolboy in any country, other than this one, could demolish the whole argument in 2 minutes. But look, you had three buildings in Lower Manhattan, at least two of them white elephant money-losing buildings, each of which collapsed onto its own footprint in 10, 9, and 6.5 seconds respectively, in a collapse that bore every single characteristic of a well-managed controlled demolition. The near free-fall speed of the collapse, the reports of multiple rapid explosions just before the collapse, the squib clouds of smoke and dust just before the collapse, the huge horizontal blast, the cauliflower-shaped clouds of tons of finely pulverized concrete and glass, the total disappearance of the dozens of massive central steel columns in the Twin Towers, the lack of one surviving desk or chair or telephone or 1 square foot of corrugated steel subflooring, all this pulverization caused by 19 young Arabs who could barely fly a Cessna, and molten steel and molten iron in the basement that glowed for months afterwards, and particles of high-explosive thermite, particularly nanothermite, found all over the place in the millions of tons of pulverized dust everywhere. So for the Rube Goldberg explanation, go to the 9/11 Commission report. Those of us who can drag ourselves out of deep denial, even if kicking and screaming, we'll apply Occam's Razor and conclude the official fairy tale is so implausible and so complex and so convoluted that it's unbelievable on its face. The alternative theory, that nothing resembles three well-managed controlled demolitions so much as three well-managed controlled demolitions, is so obviously preferable that I can't believe that moderately sane people are calling people like us conspiracy theorists. Incidentally, the official government version of events also theorizes a conspiracy. So every explanation is a conspiracy theory, and your choice is between the Rube Goldberg version and a couple of much simpler and more plausible versions. Do you know Rube Goldberg? He was a cartoonist who drew pictures of the most hilarious, overcomplicated, unlikely machines ever. Every one had at least 75 more moving parts than necessary. Like, I'm making this up now. A Rube Goldberg back scratcher would have a candle burning under a string. When the string burned through and broke, that would release a mouse from a wire cage. As he dashed to get a cube of cheese, the mouse would accidentally trip a lever, which would fire a spring-powered miniature toy missile, which would fly into a big push button, and, well, you get the idea. Eventually, something would move up and down and scratch your back. Rube Goldberg was America's greatest denier of Occam's razor before 9/11. And, of course, Goldberg meant it all as a joke, and we took it all as a joke. The 9/11 Commission report really makes you appreciate the skill and the artistry of that other cover-up commission, the Warren Commission on the Death of President John F. Kennedy. Executive Director Alan W. Dulles, who is probably Kennedy's most prominent murderer, did a stunning, superb job at concocting a plausible whitewash, with hours of testimony to back it up. Neocon hack Philip Zelikow, who ran the 9/11 Commission, revealed himself to be a pale shadow of that great master of deceit, director of the CIA until Kennedy fired him, Alan W. Dulles. Zelikow, you're junior varsity at best, maybe intramurals. That's what the deindustrialization of America has brought us. Almost nobody's a craftsman anymore. Alan Dulles, I salute you, and your equally whacked out brother, John Foster Dulles. You were a vile psychopath who did everything in your power to start World War III, but you are a craftsman. As you can see, like the many turning Odysseus, we have returned to the subject of psychopaths. Incidentally, another translation of many turning, polythropos, is devious. Now, a quick review before the test. First, psychopaths are not necessarily hands-on ruthless killers. The Son of Sam, Charles Manson, Hannibal Lecter, William J. Clinton, sure, they were all psychopaths, but so are millions of people who never actually killed anyone. The essence is, the psychopath can hurt other people and feel absolutely no remorse. Not a twinge of conscience. They're unable to feel or even imagine tender emotions such as grief and sorrow. Zero empathy. If they're a politician, they could easily kill 20,000 people abroad in order to carry Ohio, or drown hundreds in the New Orleans ethnic cleansing in order to boost real estate values, keep Louisiana a red state, and turn the property along the riverfront into a whiter shade of pale. Now, here are the really scary parts. Psychopaths are not rare. Psychiatric researchers estimate that 4 or 5% of people in our culture are born psychopaths. That's approximately the same number of gays and lesbians in our culture. Kinsey said 10%, but I think the consensus is about half that. Do you know any gays and lesbians? I know about 20 out gays and lesbians, and I live in Central Connecticut. And who knows how many of my acquaintances are still in the closet? How many psychopaths do I know? Statistically, probably the same number. 20, 25, 30. But the psychos are very good at camouflaging their natural advantage over the rest of us 95%. Now, in clawing their way to the top of any hierarchy, psychopaths have a great advantage over the other 95% who are their competitors. They are literally ruthless. They are unencumbered by any conscience, by any concern for the suffering of others. Sidebar comment, that's what ruth means. In his poem Lycidas, Milton wrote, "Look homeward, angel, and melt with ruth." Thousands of undergraduates think he's talking about hot sex with a beautiful Jewish girl. Dream on, guys. Incidentally, it's even better than you imagine. Back to the text. Consequently, every hierarchy becomes top-heavy with psychopaths. You have a highly hierarchical society, you're going to have a society run by psychopath for the benefit of psychopaths. Occam's razor. You want to explain U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East? We're giving white phosphorus bombs to Israel, which is dropping them on UN refugee centers in Gaza City. Well, why not? Dow Chemical is a big political contributor, or whoever makes the damn things. Reliable statistics prove that the U.S. killed 1 million Iraqis in the decade following Gulf War I, begun 1991. Killed them under Pappy Bush, and mostly Clinton and W. Bush. 1 million, half of them children. They died from hunger and from waterborne diseases such as typhoid and dysentery, because a U.S.-enforced regime of oppressive sanctions would not let the Iraqis import parts to repair the water treatment plants we had bombed, or the chemicals those plants needed, or repair the electric power plants we had bombed that produced the electricity that the water treatment plants and the sewage treatment plants and the irrigation pumps and the people desperately needed. And we kept out medicines and medical equipment that the people desperately needed. And children were dying from diabetes because we wouldn't let the Iraqis import insulin. Or would change our minds and let in insulin, but keep out the hypodermic needles they needed to inject the insulin. And children were dying, and we were killing them, and the UN issued a report saying that 500,000 Iraqi children had died because of the sanctions. And on network TV, reporter Leslie Stahl asked Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, if the 500,000 juvenile deaths had been worth it. And Albright replied that, well, that's a hard question, but yes, we think it was worth it. And in true American journalism fashion, Leslie Stahl did not follow up by asking, exactly what did we accomplish by killing these 500,000 children? And incidentally, another 500,000 of their parents. And we were bombing them every day at the same time. And for what? What did the psychopaths ruling us accomplish in exchange for these million deaths? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's 1 million dead people in Iraq. Now around 1.5 million have died as a result of America's 2003 invasion and ongoing occupation, plus assorted others in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, if your arithmetic skills are still sharp, you will calculate this is 2.5 million dead Iraqis, which is 40% of the number of Jews Hitler killed. Yeah, Hitler's still ahead, but we're not talking orders of magnitude here. Occam's razor. What's the simplest explanation of why all this has been allowed to happen? Well, we had things to gain. The stock price of General Dynamics is up. The stock price of Halliburton and Dow Chemical are up. And if it causes a little inconvenience to some funny brown people half a world away, well, as Junie B. Jones would say, too bad for them. The psychopaths have risen to the top of the huge hierarchy that is government and Wall Street and the Pentagon. What would you expect? The awkward question is, why are the normal 95% allowing them to continue? Let's hear a few voices in addition to my own. One of the most striking psychopaths now wielding great power is billionaire financier George Soros, founder of the Open Society Institute. Soros is a Hungarian Jew. When he was 14, the Nazis occupied Hungary. Soros presented himself to the Gestapo as a Gentile. Then, supposedly masquerading as a Jew, he went around to Jewish families, promising to help them escape persecution by the Nazis. In the process, he'd find out where the Jewish families held their wealth. He'd share this information with the Gestapo. And the next day, the Gestapo would arrest the Jews and ship them off to Treblinka, or wherever, in boxcars, and confiscate their wealth, which they now knew where it was hidden. In a 1998 interview on 60 Minutes, reporter Steve Croft queries Soros about the role he played in promoting the Holocaust. Soros reveals not the slightest twinge of regret in the face of Croft's highly skilled questioning. Another craftsman I salute, Steve Croft. We'll hear an introduction to this episode of Soros' life. Canadian radio host Alex Jones is interviewing a fellow named Bob Chapman. Then James Corbett reads aloud the 60 Minutes transcript of Croft's interview with Soros. I will note that the 12-year-old transcript is no longer posted on the 60 Minutes website. But I've read the transcript, preserved on another web page, and will say it looks very authentic to me.
And as you know, he got his start by deceiving Jewish people in the country in which he was born while working for the Gestapo so that they could confiscate the goods of Jews, he being Jewish himself. Did you know that? Well, Soros, very simply, was probably 12, 14 years old at the time, and the Germans had invaded, and the Germans were rounding up Jews to send them to internment camps and slave labor camps and extermination camps or whatever. And his job, because he was taken on with the Gestapo, I assume he told them that he wasn't Jewish. Very despicable, because what he did was go to Jewish families and tell them, look, I'm Jewish, and I'll help you hide your stuff and get you out of the country and that sort of thing. And he found out where their wealth was, and, you know, the next day they marched in with the Gestapo and took their wealth and then, you know, put them on a train and sent them someplace. And so, you know, this is the worst of the worst. It's just like Madoff and what he did to all the Jewish charities and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that as a human being. And I just want to let people know this arrogant, connected member of the Illuminati, where he's coming from. And it's not a very illustrious history, that's for sure.
Sickening, appalling, perhaps even shocking, but nonetheless quite true. And in order to document and back up some of the things that they were talking about in that clip, let's turn to some documentation. First of all, from SorosMonitor.com, we have a posting from the 26th of September 2006 regarding an interview that George Soros gave to 60 Minutes back in 1998, in which he discussed, well, one of the more surprising aspects of what he was doing in the Holocaust and what he felt about his role. Reading from that transcript from the 1998 60 Minutes interview with George Soros, Steve Croft, the interviewer, starts by asking, quote, "You're a Hungarian Jew, Mr. Soros." "Mm-hmm." "Croft, who escaped the Holocaust?" "Mr. Soros." "Mm-hmm." "Croft, by posing as a Christian?" "Mr. Soros." "Right." "Croft, and you watched lots of people get shipped off to the death camps?" "Soros." "Right. I was 14 years old, and I would say that's when my character was made." "Croft, in what way?" "Soros, that one should think ahead. One should understand and anticipate events, and when one is threatened. It was a tremendous amount of evil. I mean, it was a very personal experience of evil." "Croft, my understanding is that you went out with this protector of yours who swore that you were his adopted godson." "Soros, yes, yes." "Croft, went out, in fact, and helped in the confiscation of property from the Jews." "Soros, yes, that's right, yes." "Croft, I mean, that sounds like an experience that would send lots of people to the psychiatric couch for many, many years. Was it difficult?" "Soros, not at all, not at all. Maybe as a child you don't see the connection, but it created no problem at all." "Croft, no feeling of guilt?" "Soros, no." "Croft, for example, that I'm Jewish and here I am watching these people go, I could just as easily be there, I should be there. None of that?" "Soros, well, of course I could be on the other side, or I could be the one from whom the thing is being taken away, but there was no sense that I shouldn't be there, because that was, well, actually, in a funny way, it's just like in markets, that if I weren't there, of course I wasn't doing it, but somebody else would be taking it away anyhow. And it was the, whether I was there or not, I was only a spectator. The property was being taken away. So I had no role in taking away that property. So I had no sense of guilt." End quote. for anyone who does not yet get the general idea of where Mr. Soros is coming from and what type of psychology he might correspond to, you might be advised to check out episode 90 of this podcast, Our Leaders Are Psychopaths.
Finally, let's turn to a very interesting article by Dr. Kevin Barrett, titled Twilight of the Psychopaths. I have edited and condensed the heck out of it. You can find the original through a link on the show's webpage, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Dr. Barrett writes, "Civilization as we know it is largely the creation of psychopaths. All civilizations have been based on slavery and warfare. Incidentally, the latter term is a euphemism for mass murder. Psychopaths have played a disproportionate role in the development of civilization because they are hardwired to lie, kill, injure, and generally inflict great suffering on other humans without feeling any remorse. Thus, they have enjoyed a significant advantage over non-psychopaths in the struggle for power in hierarchies, especially military hierarchies. Military institutions are tailor-made for psychopathic killers. The 5% or so of human males who feel no remorse about killing their fellow human beings make the best soldiers. And the 95% who are extremely reluctant to kill make terrible soldiers, unless they are brainwashed with highly sophisticated modern techniques that turn them, temporarily it is hoped, into functional psychopaths." In his book On Killing, 1996, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman writes persuasively that military science is less about strategy and technology than about overcoming the instinctive human reluctance to kill members of our own species. The true revolution in military affairs was not Donald Rumsfeld's move to high tech in 2001, but Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall's discovery in the 1940s that only 15 to 20% of World War II soldiers along the line of fire would use their weapons. Quote, "Those 80 to 85% who did not fire, did not run and hide. In many cases, they were willing to risk grave danger to rescue comrades, get ammunition, or run messages. But they simply would not fire their weapons at the enemy, even when faced with repeated waves and bonsai charges." Unquote. Subsequent research proved that in all previous wars, too, a tiny minority of soldiers, the 5% who are natural-born psychopaths, and perhaps a few temporarily insane imitators, did almost all the killing. Normal men just went through the motions, and, if at all possible, refused to take the life of an enemy soldier, even if that meant giving up their own. The implication: wars are ritualized mass murders by psychopaths of non-psychopaths. This cannot be good for humanity's genetic endowment. Marshall's work brought a Copernican revolution to military science. In the past, everyone believed that the soldier willing to kill for his country was the norm, while the one who refused to fight was a cowardly aberration. The truth, as it turned out, was that the normative soldier hailed from the psychopathic 5%. The sane majority would rather die than fight. The implication was that the norms for soldiers' behavior in battle had been set by psychopaths. That meant that psychopaths were in control of the military as an institution. Worse, it meant that psychopaths were in control of society's perception of military affairs. Evidently, psychopaths exercised an enormous amount of power in a seemingly sane, normal society. How could that be? Researcher Andrei Lobachevsky explained that clinical psychopaths enjoy advantages even in nonviolent competitions to climb the ranks of social hierarchies. Because they can lie without remorse and without the telltale physiological stress that is measured by lie detector tests, psychopaths can always say whatever is necessary to get what they want. In court, for example, psychopaths can tell extreme, bald-faced lies in a plausible manner, while their sane opponents are handicapped by an emotional predisposition to remain within hailing distance of the truth. Too often, the judge or jury imagines that the truth must be somewhere in the middle, and then issues decisions that benefit the psychopath. As with judges and juries, So too with those charged with decisions concerning who to promote and who not to promote in corporate, military, and governmental hierarchies. The result is that all hierarchies inevitably become top-heavy with psychopaths. So-called conspiracy theorists often imagine that secret societies of Jews, Jesuits, bankers, communists, Bilderbergers, Muslim extremists, Papists, and so on, are threatening to take over the world. I offer an alternative conspiracy theory, which is both simpler and more accurate than the prevailing wisdom. The only conspiracy that matters is the conspiracy of psychopaths against the rest of us. Sidebar comment, and getting back to Occam's razor, we know that a simpler theory is a better theory. Back to the text. Behind the apparent insanity of contemporary history is the actual insanity of psychopaths fighting to preserve their disproportionate power. Why does a psychopathocracy fear it is losing control? Because it is threatened by the spread of knowledge. The greatest fear of any psychopath is being found out. As George Herbert Walker Bush said to journalist Sarah McClendon in December 1992, if the people knew what we had done, they would chase us down the street and lynch us. Psychopaths go through life knowing they are completely different from other people. They quickly learn to hide their lack of empathy while carefully studying others' emotions so as to mimic normalcy while cold-bloodedly manipulating the normals. Today, thanks to new information technologies, we are on the brink of unmasking the psychopaths and building a civilization of, by, and for the normal human being. A civilization without war, a civilization based on truth, a civilization in which the saintly few, rather than the diabolical few, would gravitate to positions of power. We already have the knowledge necessary to diagnose psychopathic personalities and keep them out of power. We have the knowledge necessary to dismantle the institutions in which psychopaths especially flourish: militaries, intelligence agencies, large corporations, and secret societies. We need to disseminate this knowledge and develop the will to use it as widely as possible. Above all, we need to inform the public about how psychopaths co-opt and corrupt normal human beings. One way they do this is by manipulating shame and denial, emotions foreign to psychopaths, but common and easily induced among normals. All of this psychopathic behavior at the top of the social hierarchy is simply too shameful for ordinary people to see, so they avert their gaze, just as wives of husbands who are sexually abusing their children sometimes refuse to see what is happening in plain view. But thanks to the internet, people everywhere are waking up. The only obvious non-psychopath among Republican presidential candidates, Ron Paul, also happens to be the only candidate in either party with grassroots support. I'll stop Barrett's essay here with a note that apparently was written prior to the 2008 nominating conventions, and that, of course, Barack Obama soon developed huge popular support. Obama gave the appearance of being among the 95% of Americans with normal human values and ethics. Many millions of voters had not the slightest idea of Obama's voting record during his brief term in the Senate, and the voters desperately yearned for a national government based on sanity and democratic values. Whether their wish was granted, I will leave to each listener to decide. And thank you for listening. Thank you to Teresa Caraggio, www.thirdparadigm.org, for turning me on to Kevin Barrett's Twilight of the Psychopaths. And thanks to James Corbett for some of the audio for today's show, www.corbettreport.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, and please tune in again. Ciao.